our breakfast area. Having never seen this type of owl, we were awed and stood to admire it. They are large and elegant animals. We saw that one of our cats was also on the deck and wondered how the two animals would react to each other. Our cat slowly walked to the railing and reached up toward the owl. The owl, which could easily have eaten it for a snack, gave our cat a quick look, disregarded it, and continued to stare in our direction. The owl seemed to have concern only for us. Throughout that day and subsequent days, the owl appeared to follow us as we moved from room to room. My stepfather and I continued to have a loving disagreement over the telephone about which of us needed my mother's help more. He said me, and I said him, until by the week's end I was determined to send my mother home. As my mother was climbing into the taxi to begin her trip home, the great gray owl settled onto a nearby post and simply stared at me insistently as it had done all week. I could not ignore the intensity of its gaze and felt as though it would come and land directly on my head if I didn't immediately give it my full attention. The bird clearly had something to say, and when I finally paid attention, I felt the owl urging me to go with my mother to North Carolina. My stepfather and I had an extremely close and important bond. If George were to die without my being present, I knew I would be devastated and overcome with remorse. Despite my continued disability and the difficulty of traveling in my condition, I decided to accompany my mother. I grabbed my purse, gave one last look of gratitude to the owl for its guidance and persistence, and tried to scramble into the taxi. The trip to North Carolina was ambitious and arduous. We had rushed to the Jackson Hole Airport, but just missed the last flight for the day. A friend graciously drove us 5 hours to the Salt Lake City Airport, but spending the night in the back seat of his pickup truck while we waited for the next flight was not very restful, to say the least. When we finally arrived at the side of my stepfather's hospital bed, we found him to be in good spirits. George's son, Larry, was also present, and we had some wonderful and loving conversations. We all celebrated my mother's birthday in George's hospital room the next day. George laughed, felt great, and was even able to eat a bit of his favorite food, cookies. My mom and I were quite relieved at his condition and were in high spirits the next morning. We sat at her breakfast table sipping coffee and contemplating George's health and the possibility of his release from the hospital. As we chatted, we looked out the picture window and gazed upon a large, entirely barren Bradford pear tree. My mother then told me the story of that tree. She and George loved the large pink blossoms of the many Bradford pear trees in their neighborhood, so they had planted this tree many years prior with the hope of enjoying its annual display of color. While this particular tree had continued to grow taller and taller, it had never produced a single blossom. She said that George was so dismayed by the tree's inability to blossom that he planned to cut it down in the spring and plant a new one. He loved color and wanted to see blossoms from their breakfast table. We were still feeling hopeful as we drove to the hospital, but encountered a radically different situation upon our arrival. George had taken a turn for the worse, and his organs were failing. God was calling to him, and we knew that his remaining time on earth was short. My mom, Larry, and I decided to let him pass into the next world with dignity and love. We removed the feeding tube and chose not to place him on a ventilator. We each expressed our deep love for George and each gave him permission to leave. We held each other and held George as his spirit peacefully left this world. The following morning, as we sat down for coffee at my mom's breakfast table, we looked out the window and gasped. Their once forlorn Bradford pear tree was bursting with color. This tree, which had been barren just 24 hours earlier, was now filled beyond capacity with large, beautiful, perfect pink blossoms. These colorful blossoms stayed on that tree until well after frost had felled the blossoms of neighboring trees. When this tree finally began to drop its leaves, it did so on the side facing away from the window before dropping a single blossom on the side that faced my mother's breakfast window. What a gift from my stepfather. What a miracle. My mother subsequently commissioned a painting of that tree with its bounty of blossoms, which she gave to me in celebration of George and of our shared experience. I have hung this painting in my bathroom dressing area, and it gives me a deep sense of peace and contentment every time I look at it. My return trip to Jackson Hole was taxing, but calm. No fire alarms or other such unexpected difficulties. When I finally arrived in my driveway, I saw the great gray owl land once again. It settled onto a post within arm's reach of me, and we fondly regarded each other. With tears in my eyes and gratitude in my heart, I recognized the angel within the owl and gave thanks for the compassionate guidance it had given me. I have never seen that owl since. Its presence reminded me once again that God loves us, directs our steps, and is always available to us in one manner or another. Truly, God's messengers are everywhere and come to us in the forms that we can and will accept. That may mean a great gray owl or other sort of creature to one person and a human being to another. As I mentioned earlier in this book when describing one of my conversations with an angel in a sun-drenched field in heaven, there are angels all around us, and we each have personal angels who watch over us all day, every day. They help us, nudge us, and guide us in all sorts of little ways that we usually don't notice. Sometimes they push us forward, and sometimes they pull us backward. Always, they want very much for us to follow the path that has been laid out for us by God. Chapter 22. Inspiration to Others. I will praise you, O Lord, with all my heart. I will tell of all the marvelous things you have done. I will be filled with joy because of you. I will sing praises to your name, O Most High. Psalm 9, verses 1 and 2, New Living Translation. A couple of months later, when I had physically recovered some and become a little more mobile, I was asked to speak to groups at several local churches. There was great interest in hearing my story, and I was happy to share my experience of God's miraculous interventions in my life. Portions of my story have been recounted on many occasions since then and by numerous people. An audio-recorded version of my original presentation is still being circulated. I see this continued interest in my story as a demonstration of people's desire to be inspired by and believe in the possibility of God's intervention. It is often difficult to believe that an all-powerful God could possibly care about each one of us individually, or be willing to directly intervene in our lives. I am a scientist. I understand numbers and statistics. I am skeptical and a bit cynical. There are so many of God's creations on this planet, and we are each so small. I wonder how any individual can be significant when compared to the universe, and how it could be possible for God to know us individually, let alone love us deeply and intercede when necessary. What a scientist cannot account for is the alteration of time and space and dimension that is God's. I certainly cannot understand how it works, but I have experienced it, and I accept that each one of us is a special and valued child of God. We are humans and do not have the capacity to understand God or begin to understand God's capabilities. Consider this as a paltry example. Does a parent with multiple children run out of love? Does that same parent value one child less just because they also have other children? Or do they love the child less who occasionally makes them angry? The answer to all of these hypothetical questions, of course, is no. The more we love, the more love we have to offer. So it is with God's love for us. It is inexhaustible. God definitely knows each one of us, I mean know in an absolute, complete, and pure sense. Like a seamstress knows her dress when she has grown the cotton from a seed, spun the cotton fibers into thread, woven the fabric, and stitched the fabric together to make a dress. Or like a carpenter knows the chair that he has crafted by hand from a tree that he himself planted, nurtured, and felled. God knew each of us even before he sent us into our mother's womb. Not only did the telling of my story give others inspiration and hope, it also freed a great many people to tell their own stories. I cannot count the number of people who have approached me or called me asking for a couple of minutes of my time. Each one of them begins their conversation the same way. I want to tell you about something that happened to me. I never told anyone about it because I didn't think anyone would believe me. Then each proceeds to tell me of an extraordinary experience that occurred in which they interacted with angels, communicated with God's messengers, or spent time with spirits. Each of them feels liberated after telling me of their experiences, and it is clear that each feels validated by talking to me. The human brain is quite good at remembering events, but not usually so adept at remembering the precise details. If you ask most people to describe their wedding, a child's birth, or other such important life events, the tiny details will have faded, and the stories will likely have changed some over time. Think about fishermen's tales, which grow with each telling, or the old-time game of telephone, in which a story is whispered from one person to the next. The last person in line tells the story out loud, and when compared to the original version, is usually full of notable differences. Even vivid dreams rarely stay in our memories for more than a few minutes. I have observed one of the truly remarkable and consistent aspects of accounts of experiences that involve the presence or intervention of God is that the description of the experience remains constant no matter how much time has elapsed. People who have been involved in a godly experience remember with clarity and constancy the details of the incident and vividly recall their emotions as though they had just occurred. The stories of almost everyone who has spoken with me began with some sort of traumatic situation. This is fairly predictable, and it is unfortunate that we rarely have such intense spiritual connections except under conditions of dire stress. I believe that anyone can have the same connections and experiences that I have had, but I think we are too distracted by the world around us when we are under normal circumstances. When we are in dire circumstances, these distractions quickly fall away, and we are able to discern that which is most important, our relationship with God. Under ordinary circumstances, it is usually quite difficult to voluntarily remove these distractions in order to experience God. Paul Hayden, my minister, likens it to the frequencies on a radio. We must tune our soul to the right frequency in order to hear the blessings being sent to us from God. One day, after I had recovered enough to return to my medical practice, a woman who I knew arrived at my office without an appointment. She knew it was my busiest day of the work week, but she insisted on speaking with me. Now, to understand this part of the story, you must understand our shared history. Shortly after I began my medical practice in Wyoming, this woman's husband came to me for care. He underwent a major surgery, which I performed and had no difficulties. His hospital course after surgery was entirely uncomplicated. He felt great, and by the third day, I was beginning to plan his discharge from the hospital. Unbeknownst to me, my patient and his wife had visited with their Latter-day Saints bishop prior to this surgery and had received blessings from him. He had told my patient's wife that she would have to give up the thing that she loved the most. He told my patient that God was very pleased with him, that the veil between this world and the next would be very thin, and that he would be required to make a choice. Before surgery, my patient and his wife had discussed together their interpretation of these blessings. They had concluded that my patient would have to choose between continued life on earth or physical death. They were both spiritually devoted and knew that my patient would choose God. On the fourth day after his surgery, my patient suddenly dropped dead while in the bathroom. His wife later told me that throughout the day of his passing, her husband had been speaking with angels who he said were in the room with them. He kept asking her if she could see them and was disappointed that she couldn't. He told her how much he loved and valued her as a wife, but that he had to go with the angels and that he would visit her. Now back to the story. Given this background and the fact that she had driven several hours to see me, I could not refuse her request for a bit of my time. We sat in the outdoor courtyard, and she apologized profusely for interrupting my day, but she had something of great importance to tell me. She was very worried that something terrible was about to happen to me, and she felt like she needed to warn me. She told me that in the time since her husband's death, his spirit would occasionally visit their home and give her guidance. She had not seen him for many months, but he had come into her dreams the day before she drove to my office. During this visitation, her husband had been excited and jubilant. He told her that I had been in a terrible accident, and that he had asked the Heavenly Father if he could be one of those sent to save me. As he described it to her, his request had been honored, and he was so pleased to have been able to walk beside me and lift me up during that time. His wife had not known anything of my boating accident in Chile, but she was able to give details of the scene that were known only to those who were present. After she completed her story and added her plea that I be careful, I told her the story of my accident. Although she was startled by the past tense of my story, she was not shocked by the story itself, as her husband had already told her many of the same details. Chapter 23. God Rolls the Stone Away. Praying in faith is not an inner conviction that God will act according to our desires if only we believe hard enough. It involves believing that God will always respond to our prayers in accord with His nature, His purposes, and His promises. Alvin Vandergrind. After my kayaking accident, I felt as though I didn't belong in the world and felt isolated. I was depressed at being on Earth and was consumed with trying to understand what had happened to me and what I was supposed to do with the knowledge I gained. In trying to understand my experience, I read many accounts of other people's near-death experiences. I found some comfort in knowing that my emotions, reactions, and frustrations were common after this sort of experience. I, like so many others who have experienced death, no longer felt the pull of earthly concerns. As a result, I became limitlessly more tolerant of the behavior of others, but far less tolerant of my personal involvement with them. I had always sought total integration in my life, but now I was driven to such. It was my goal always to be an honest, ethical, and godly woman in my personal life, my family life, and my professional life. I intended to live a prayerful life of thanksgiving and joy, and it became increasingly important to me that I spend my time with like-minded people. Bill and I both became increasingly frustrated by the attitudes and behavior of some of our medical partners, and by 2004, we thought it best if we charted our own course. We wanted out, but leaving our medical group was a risky decision for us. It was the only orthopedic group in town, and everyone in the partnership had signed a non-compete agreement. We felt justified in leaving, but it was possible that our non-compete agreement would be enforced and we would need to leave town in search of work. We were struggling with our uncertainty when we left in the spring for a family vacation to Virgin Gorda, an island in the British Virgin Islands. We were still anxious about it when we awoke on Easter morning, but God tells us not to fear and promises, "I am with you, I will strengthen you, I will help you, I will uphold you." In keeping with God's promises, Easter morning proved to be a new beginning for our family. We went to a sermon in the resort's beachside conference room, where we listened to an energetic island preacher whose charisma enveloped the gathering. He did not preach on the usual topics of Jesus' death and resurrection. He chose to speak about the fear felt by the guards and about the power of God, on that day of Christ's resurrection. He pointed out that the Romans were so afraid of Jesus, despite their claims of his being nothing special, that they securely sealed his tomb and posted guards on all sides. On the third day after Jesus' death, there was a violent earthquake as an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and rolled back the stone to Jesus' tomb. The point the preacher made when discussing this story was that when God is involved, nothing can prevent the stone from being rolled away. Bill and I felt that God was involved in our lives and that it was time to roll away our stone and be set free. As soon as we left the service, we electronically submitted our letters of resignation to our office manager. We were ecstatic when we received confirmation of their receipt and celebrated the coming of our unknown future. Within a couple of months, we moved into our own offices and formed a new medical practice together. We have never looked back. When God is present, things happen. Our practice thrived, and when Dr. Alvis Forbes returned from his military service in the Gulf War, he also left our previous orthopedic group and joined us. A man of great integrity, he shared our commitment to an integrated, God-centered way of life, and we knew we had made the right choice. Chapter 24. Willie. God's plan and his ways of working out his plans are frequently beyond our ability to fathom and understand. We must learn to trust when we don't understand. Jerry Bridges. Much of what I was told by the angel in the field had to do with my oldest son, Willie. Before I introduce you to Willie, I need to categorically state once again that I believe very young children clearly remember where they came from and are still quite connected to God's world. I believe they easily recall the images, knowledge, and the love of the world they inhabited before their birth. I believe children may still be able to see angels, and many other people have written about this phenomenon. As young children become more engaged with the world, their memories fade and they begin their personal journey, often filled with detours and dead ends, of finding their way back to God. Ultimately, they must not only find God, but must freely choose to accept God's love and direction. God gave humans this ability to choose freely, which makes us ultimately responsible for our choices, our actions, and our lives. Free choice requires that a person first understand that the choice he or she makes is fully theirs, and that they are not being made to choose by something or someone other than themselves. It also requires that they choose between two or more alternatives, only one of which can be realized at a given time. For example, a person can choose to accept or reject a dinner invitation, but cannot do both at the same time. As described by scholars of psychology, this inability to simultaneously choose more than one alternative creates internal emotional conflict. This internal conflict has been shown to lead to a person's greater examination of their choices, with resulting increased perceived value and a stronger embrace of his or her final choice. Each person can choose God or reject God, but cannot choose to do both simultaneously. By freely choosing to believe God's promises, a person's faith may be more strongly embraced and therefore less likely to falter in times of struggle, sadness, or other such difficulties. During my initial hospitalization after my accident in Chile, when I was speaking with Jesus in the sun-drenched field, I asked him why everyone on earth wasn't given the opportunity to have the same experience that I was having. It seemed that if everyone shared this experience, hatred would disappear. We would be better stewards of the earth, eradicate hunger, no longer wage wars, and generally treat one another better on a daily basis. I no longer remember the angel's exact words, but his amused response reiterated Jesus' comments to Thomas. Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and have yet believed. John 20, verse 29, New International Version. That is not to say that older children and adults have no memory. It seems that God sends us to earth with a deeply rooted desire to seek meaning and spirituality, and until we satisfy this desire, we experience a void in our souls. Some people fill this void with God, some fill it with material possessions or other worldly desires, and some try not to feel this void by deadening their senses with drugs or alcohol. It is with this understanding of my belief that I will tell this next part of my story. Willie and I had always been very close, and I always felt a sense of deep spiritual connection with his soul. When he was young, perhaps 4 or 5, he and I were chatting before bed. I do not recall what prompted the comment, but I said something about, "When you are 18, Willie looked startled and said, "But I am not going to be 18. I asked him, "What did you say?" with a somewhat joking tone. He looked back at me with serious intensity, curiosity, and disbelief as he said, "You know, I'm never going to be 18. That's the plan. You know that." He said it as though I must be kidding with him. Surely I must know the plan for his life. This exchange was like a knife to my heart. I never forgot it and did not dismiss it. I cherished each subsequent day I had with this son, wondering which one will be his last. In the years following my boating accident, I intermittently thought about my conversation with Jesus regarding Willie and contemplated the reasons for my return to Earth. Given Willie's long-ago stated certainty that he would not reach the age of 18, I assumed that the expectations regarding Willie had less to do with his protection and more to do with my expected role in helping my husband and my family after Willie's death. Not wanting to burden others with these thoughts, I held them inside and did not tell anyone. It seemed to become a waiting game, but as the date of Willie's 18th birthday neared, I became filled with anticipatory grief. I finally told my husband about my conversation with our son that had occurred so many years earlier. I'm not sure that he was glad to share my burden of worry, but it certainly made me feel just a little better to tell him about it. On a Saturday night during the summer before Willie's 18th birthday, I had a dream in which a boy, who I did not know, told me that he had traded places with Willie. I awoke confused and bewildered. I was quite startled later in the day to discover that the boy in my dream, a well-liked and well-respected young man in our community, had been killed the prior afternoon in a motor vehicle accident while on his way to a swim meet. I felt guilty and conflicted in my emotions. I was filled with sadness at another family's loss, but relieved that perhaps our family would be spared. A couple of months later, we received a phone call telling us of the tragic news that one of our dear friends died suddenly and unexpectedly while in a hunting camp. 4 days later, we received a similar call telling us of the sudden and unexpected death of Alvis, our medical partner. They were both dear friends and bigger-than-life sorts of people who had been active in the Jackson Hole community for many years. We were devastated. The community was reeling, and our office was a place of mourning. In our country, we no longer seem to have funerals. Instead, we have celebrations of life. But truly, the only person who ever celebrates is the one who died. Those who have died experience the joy of returning to the glory of God's world, while the people left behind are sad, lonely, and rarely feel joyful about the occasion. I am not superstitious, but events frequently occur in threes. Our community was mourning 3 deaths. Could this be another indication that Willie's long-ago prediction would come to nothing? This question was on my heart 1 month prior to his birthday, when Willie, Elliot, and Betsy left home to attend a ski camp in Sweden. The three of them drove to Salt Lake City, where they spent the night before going to the airport early the following morning. After they checked their bags, Elliot and Betsy stayed at the airport while Willie drove back to the hotel, where he had originally planned to leave the car parked. When he realized that he did not have enough time to return to the hotel and take the shuttle back to catch the flight, he decided to return to the parking lot at the airport and leave the car there. On his way back to the airport, he exited the freeway and stopped behind a few cars that were lined up at a red light on the exit ramp. His foot slipped off the brake, and the car moved forward several feet, gently striking the bumper of the car in front of him. He didn't think this was a serious problem, but got out of his car anyway and walked up to the other car. The other driver had not moved his car to the side of the roadway, did not get out of his car, did not open his window, and would not look at Willie. Confused by this driver's behavior, Willie returned to his own car, pulled to the side of the road, and called me on his cell phone. Thinking that maybe the other driver had not seen Willie, or even noticed that his car had been struck, although why else would he have stopped on the exit ramp, I suggested that Willie return to the other car and tap on the window to get the other driver's attention. He did so, but got the same result. He returned to his car and again called me. I suggested that Willie write our insurance information on a piece of paper to give to the other driver, walk to the car while keeping me on the phone, and offer to have me speak with the other driver. I listened from my end of the phone line as Willie walked to the car for the third time and asked the driver if he would speak with me. I heard silence, followed by a piercing scream. The other driver had produced a handgun and was pointing it directly at Willie. Willie was frozen with fear, but fortunately his phone was frozen to his ear. As a result, I did not have to overcome his screaming to speak to him. I was able to speak directly into his brain. Run. Get in your car, turn the key in the ignition, drive away. Do not stop. I certainly do not know if my son would have been shot had I not been on the phone with him when the other driver pointed his gun at Willie. What I do know, however, is that I am the only person who could have broken through to Willie's brain and given him instructions that he would unquestioningly follow. I believe that on that day in Salt Lake City, my son reached a branch point in his life that led either to the death he had predicted so many years earlier or to his continued life. Despite the angel's earlier words that I would need to be a rock of support for my family and community after Willie's death, I felt like the plan for Willie had changed. Because I was alive, Willie stayed alive. Chapter 25. Bill. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God. Romans 8, verse 28, New King James Version. I was also sent back to Earth to protect the health of my husband. Recall that two of our dear friends had recently died unexpectedly, and both of presumed heart attacks. They were both men about the same age as my husband, 53 years old. Like my husband, both men were physically fit and active, and neither man smoked cigarettes, drank alcohol, or used recreational drugs. Neither should have died. Both had close and loving families as well as deep faith. I did not want Bill to walk down the same road as these men, so I started pestering him to have an evaluation of his heart. Had I not returned to Earth after my boating accident and been present to prod him, Bill doubts he would even have considered being evaluated. But I was there, so he was evaluated. He had a calcium-scoring CT scan in December 2007, a specialized test that specifically evaluates the amount of calcium present in the blood vessels of the heart. It is a non-invasive way of determining if coronary artery disease is present, and if so, to what degree. The good news was that his heart looked perfect. No calcium, no coronary artery disease. When they performed the scan, however, the doctors had slightly misaligned the scanner. It was off-center by just a fraction, and on the very, very edge of the resulting images, the radiologist saw a small nodule in Bill's lung tissue. Hoping that it was evidence of an infection, Bill was placed on antibiotics. At home, we racked our brains trying to think of any unusual exposure he may have had to asbestos, tuberculosis, or one of the other types of lung infections that were frequently seen in his birthplace of Southern California. A few days later, when a repeat CT scan of his lungs showed no change in the images, he underwent a CT-guided biopsy. The results showed a malignant tumor of the lung. We arranged for removal of this tumor, which was able to be done thoracoscopically. He was discharged from the hospital after only one day, and he was gently skiing within a week. He has gone on to recover fully, and his follow-up CT scans have confirmed the absence of any recurrence. His positive outcome is likely due to the very small size of the tumor at the time of its discovery. Throughout our lives, we are conditioned to see each of the events of this sequence in isolation and to think of them as coincidental or lucky. When you consider the entire sequence of events, however, it is difficult to discount the possibility of it being miraculous. Had our two good friends not died, I would not have insisted on an evaluation. Had I died on the Chilean River, Bill would likely not have had a heart evaluation. Based on the tumor type, had the scan not been misaligned, the mass would not have been found until it was larger, making it too late to hope for a cure. If the identified mass had been 2 millimeters smaller, it would not have been visible on the scan. 3 millimeters larger, and it would have put Bill into a far more ominous statistical category with a much worse prognosis. Without my return from heaven after my boating accident, our 4 children might have become orphans. At the time, I believed this was the protection of my family, for which I had been sent back. Chapter 26. Chad. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God. Ephesians 2, verse 8, New Revised Standard Version. Chad Long was a delightful young man, but I did not know him well prior to my trip to Chile. His spiritual faith had been another explanation given to me for my return to Earth, and I was told I would play an important role in his becoming a godly man. For years, this was a source of great confusion for me, for I already believed Chad to be a godly man. He had been born into a Christian family, had married a Christian woman, and was never shy about discussing the role God played in his and his family's life. Although I knew what I had been told by the angel, I really couldn't imagine what I could contribute to Chad's faith. In preparing for the writing of this book, I spoke individually with each of the Longs. I asked them to recount, without my interruptions or comments, their recollections of the circumstances of my boating accident, and to also recall their emotions. Chad gave me his account, and as he was describing the effect the events had on his life, he disclosed that for the several years leading up to my trip to Chile, he had been in a bad place. He had not been the person he wanted to be, and felt that he had been suffering the age-old battle between God and Satan. Before going to Chile in the winter of 1999, he had been struggling in an unhealthy relationship and was lying to himself and others about the type of person he was becoming. At the end of the Chilean boating season, the year Bill and I went, Chad returned to Idaho with memories of my accident, but also re-entered the same unhealthy relationship and personal environment he had left. He wrestled with his faith, especially with the question of how to be a godly man. He said that when he allowed himself to contemplate the experiences and miracles related to my accident, he began to understand and believe that if a person can let go of the earthly logistics of life, live in faith, and give control to God, great things can happen, and the supernatural can occur. Without God, our options are limited. He points to my boating accident as a major turning point in his life, the point at which he became comfortable in his faith and comfortable in his relationship with God. It resulted in his consciously choosing to make the changes necessary to live a godly life. Chad is now reconciled with God, is no longer afraid to alienate people by being open about his faith, and he relies on God to direct his life. Speaking with him about the impact of my accident on his life resolved my long-standing confusion about what the angel had told me, and I am profoundly grateful to have been an instrument through which God called to him. Chapter 27. Compulsion to write. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, "This is the way, walk in it." Isaiah 30, verse 21, New International Version. Life in our household is hectic and usually bustling with activity. We each have a variety of interests and endeavors, which makes our daily home life exciting, interesting, and satisfying, if not always predictable. By early 2009, I had lived up to what I believe were many of God's expectations for my life, and I felt content. My husband was healthy, Our three younger kids were active, happy, and blossoming into wonderful young people, and Willie, our oldest child, was positively flourishing. In the period after his 18th birthday, Willie led a joyful, albeit frenzied, life. He had a terrific season of Nordic skiing, winning his 7th and 8th Wyoming State Championships, a record for which he was featured in Sports Illustrated, Faces in the Crowd. He also expanded the nonprofit environmental organization he created to promote local no-idling policies and enlisted the support of many local businesses for this cause. He strongly believed that encouraging people to make a conscious, environmentally based choice about turning off their car engines would prompt them to think about their other choices as well. Even small choices can make a difference when added together. He believed that we are each the ripple of hope described in Robert Kennedy's 1966 speech at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. It is from numberless, diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Willie was intrigued by the political process as a means for change, and in 2008, when he was only 18 years old, he was elected by members of our community to be a Wyoming delegate to the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado. Willie's sincerity, energy, and never-ending flow of ideas for living responsibly and making the world a better place for all was enormously contagious. He was passionate about making a difference in our world and inspired those around him to care about issues, to get involved, and to become better people in the process. It didn't matter to him what a person's issue was. He just wanted people to get involved and make a difference. I admired his passion and could not have been more delighted with the man Willie was becoming. Despite my reasonable sense of contentment, I knew I had at least one big job left to do before I could truly rest contented in God's presence. I was supposed to share my life stories and experiences by talking about them and writing about them. I knew that I had been given the many experiences of my life, my death, and my return so that I could use my experiences and observations to help others stop doubting and just believe. Believe that spiritual life is more important than our physical one. Believe that God is present and at work in our lives and our world. Believe that we are each a beautiful part of an intricate tapestry of creation. Believe that there is no such thing as coincidence. I knew what I was supposed to do. I just didn't want to do it. In the years after my boating accident, I easily followed God's edict of being joyful always, praying without ceasing, and giving thanks in all circumstances. My experiences with God were a part of every breath I took. I even named my new bicycle Breath of Life. I never stopped feeling gratitude for the blessings I had received. I just didn't feel like writing about them. I did feel increasing guilt about not completing my task, and for even thinking about it as a task rather than a privilege. I felt increasing guilt for not living up to what I imagined were God's expectations for me. I felt mounting pressure to write my story, but I just kept putting it on the bottom of the nagging list of things that I needed/wanted to get done, organizing the garage, clearing the closets of no longer used clothing, getting Christmas cards out on time, being better about writing/calling my family, organizing photo albums, and so on. I am quite good at procrastinating, so I kept living my life as usual until, quite unexpectedly, in the spring of 2009, I was awakened in the early hours by an overpowering need to put my story into words. It consumed me entirely. I popped out of bed at 4 or 5 each morning, the only hours during which I could write without being interrupted, and marveled at how effortlessly the words poured out of me and onto the computer screen. I would feverishly write for a couple of hours before starting our family's morning routine of getting ready for school and work. In 1 week, the first draft of this book was finished. I was emotionally drained, but quickly worked through a couple of revisions before losing motivation once again. It was a busy time for my family, and I let this manuscript languish for a couple of months while I focused on the activities of our daily lives. Peter was finishing his second year in middle school, Betsy was finishing her junior year of high school, and Elliot was contemplating his college choices while preparing for his high school graduation. Willie was temporarily living in Washington, D.C., enjoying all the city has to offer. And Bill and I continued to work while trying to keep everyone's schedules organized. Willie completed his time in Washington, then returned to Wyoming to help celebrate Elliot's graduation on May 29, 2009. The brothers planned to leave Jackson Hole the following weekend to begin their next adventure. They planned to drive across country and live together in northern Maine while ski training for 6 months with the Maine Winter Sports Club. The day before their departure, Willie asked me about writing a will. He wanted to know who writes a will, why a person would write a will, and whether he should write one. He also wanted to know if I had a life insurance policy for him, and upon discovering that I had never thought of it, wanted to know how I could get one. He really pestered me about it. Although I felt strange having this conversation with a healthy 19-year-old, I assured him that I would look into the matter. Emotionally, I am even-keeled, and I have never been particularly emotional when any of my kids began something new or left for an adventure. I have always been excited for them and known that we would stay in communication. The morning my two boys left for Maine was different. Willie's Subaru was overloaded with most of their worldly possessions, and as I watched them making their final preparations, I felt tears welling up in my eyes. I'm not sure why, but it reminded me of the day I took Willie to his first preschool class. On that day, which now seems like a different lifetime, he gave me a kiss, then confidently left my side and walked through the classroom door. As I watched him walk up the sidewalk and into his future, the symbolism of it all overwhelmed me, and I shocked myself by crying most of the way home. As the boys and I stood next to the Subaru saying goodbye, I kept telling them how much I loved them, told them to be careful driving, to call me from the road, and other such things mothers generally say in those moments. When we embraced, I started crying and almost couldn't let them go. I remember holding Willie just a little bit longer than I normally would have, looking directly into his eyes and telling him how much I loved him and what an extraordinary young man he had become. I told them both how proud Bill and I were of them and what a great adventure they would have together. They drove off, and despite speaking with them many times each day while they were on the road, I still felt entirely out of sorts. Perhaps I was uneasily awaiting a future that I had already seen. Chapter 28. The Longest Day of the Year. And be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Matthew 28, verse 20. New Living Translation. The boys arrived in Fort Kent, Maine, and settled into a routine. They lived in the training center with several other athletes and were excited about the training program. They trained hard and shared a lot of laughs as they explored their new surroundings. Friends of ours, Sophie and Derek, whose children had attended school with the boys, own a fishing lodge not far from where the boys were living. The lodge is in Canada, on the banks of the Grand Cascapedia River. The pace of life there is relaxed and filled with activities like swimming, fishing from canoes, playing games, and making maple syrup hearts while telling stories around a campfire. Sophie and Derek's family spends time there each summer, and the boys happily accepted their gracious invitation to visit. On one afternoon, Willie was fishing in a canoe with Sophie and two of her beautiful golden retrievers, Rusty and Lucky. Sophie is an exceptionally loving and supportive person who enjoyed listening to and encouraging all of Willie's many, many ideas for the future. Knowing that his life was more than full and usually moved at an extremely rapid pace, Sophie was surprised to see that Willie was a calm and graceful fisherman. He wasn't bored and didn't seem to care whether or not he actually caught a fish. He was simply enjoying the surrounding beauty and the ebb and flow of the river while chatting with her. Seemingly out of the blue, Willie asked Sophie what she knew about the soul. She went on to tell him that she believes the soul is the essence of being that has a direct connection to God. She told him that she believes our souls are timeless and come to earth in order to learn something new or otherwise attain spiritual growth. Willie seemed quite interested in her thoughts, asked several more questions, then quietly seemed to contemplate what she had said. He then told her how happy he was and how grateful he was for the wonderful life he had lived. They soon paddled to where Sophie's son was standing on the riverbank, and when they got out of the canoe, she marveled at Willie's ability to seamlessly transition from their deep discussion of the soul to playfully hanging out with his buddy. Willie awoke the next day and ate his 5 usual pieces of bacon, 4 eggs, 2 pieces of toast, and pancakes with homemade maple syrup, before returning to Fort Kent with Elliot to resume their ski training. In the early hours of June 21st, 2009, I again felt an absolute compulsion to finish this manuscript and an intense pressure to complete my work. By early in the afternoon, I finally completed what I believed would be the final version of my manuscript. The intensity of the elation I felt when I clicked the save button and shut down my computer was something I had never before felt and have trouble adequately describing. There was an explosion of freedom within my soul. I felt light and happy and magnificent. I was filled with relief at having completed this task and grateful for the experiences leading up to it. I had been obedient to God. Life could not have seemed better. I was still feeling lighthearted as my youngest son, Peter, and I were driving into town later that day. We decided to tease Elliot about something, so called him from my car. I must have accidentally hit the speaker button on my phone, for when the call was answered by an unfamiliar voice, Peter was also able to hear that person's words. We asked for Elliot, but the man on the other end of the call told us his name and said that Elliot could not speak. Although there had been no amusement in his voice, we thought he was trying to be funny. I hadn't actually recognized the caller's name, so I thought it was one of the other skiers in the training program. I asked him to stop kidding around and give the phone to Elliot. He again said his name, it was one of the boys' ski coaches, and told me that Willie had been involved in a roller skiing accident and was dead. As I tried to control the rising panic that was beginning to cloud my brain and constrict my breathing, I told him to stop joking around, that it was not funny, and again asked him to please hand the phone to Elliot. This conversation repeated itself again and again as I immediately turned the car around and raced home. I really couldn't even comprehend the words that he was saying. I ran into our house and screamed for my husband to talk to this man because I don't even know what he is saying. Our world was forever changed. Chapter 29. My Beautiful Son. Be still and know that I am God. Psalm 46, verse 10. New King James Version. On the other side of the country, the same day had begun with a similar sense of joy. Willie spent the morning with Elliot and then met their friend Hillary, another skier, in the afternoon at her family's home in Fort Fairfield. They planned to spend the afternoon restoring a rusty old bicycle they picked up at a garage sale earlier in the summer, then roller ski for a couple of hours before having dinner with her family. If you are unfamiliar with them, roller skis are a dry land version of cross-country ski equipment. They look a little bit like very short skis, with ski bindings mounted on the top and polyethylene wheels at either end. An athlete can use them to ski on pavement, with or without the use of ski poles. They are used by Nordic skiers to increase endurance, work on technique, and develop ski-specific strength when there is no snow. June 21st, 2009, was the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, and it was a beautiful time in New England. As they skied past a cemetery, Willie told Hillary the story of how he had told me when he was very young that he would not reach his 18th birthday, and of my coming to his West Yellowstone hotel room at 4 a.m. the morning of his birthday just to hug him and verify that he was alive. They went on to talk about death and what it meant to each of them. He then became quite specific in describing his feelings about death and told Hillary what he wanted done in the event of his death. He was clear, for example, about his desire to be cremated. He expressed his opinion that using land for burial was not consistent with his love for the planet and his passion about being a responsible steward of the land. As they skied toward their halfway point, they crested a hill overlooking a beautiful river. The sun was setting, and the golden rays of light played on the water, the trees, and the distant hills, creating a magical quality to the scene as they stopped to take it all in. Willie's final comment as they resumed skiing was, "If we died, wouldn't this be an incredible last vision?" Less than 3 minutes later, Willie was dead. Eric, a Fort Fairfield youth who had celebrated his 18th birthday just weeks earlier, had decided to just drive around that evening. When his car approached the section of road upon which Hillary and Willie were skiing, they both heard the car engine and moved as far to the right side of the road as was possible. They continued skiing along the road's edge and waited for the car to drive by. This is something every Nordic skier has experienced thousands of times during their off-season training. As they waited for the car to pass, they could not have known that Eric was distracted.